Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. This is Valley Roundup. Joining me today are Paul Mentor, columnist with the Aspen Daily News. Paul, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Allison.
We have Rick Carroll, managing editor with the Aspen Times. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Madeline Osberger, contributing editor with the Aspen Daily News. Madeline, thanks for coming in this morning.
Great to be here.
On this week's show, we look at the adventurous life of a Valley local who died in a bike accident over the weekend. We examine ongoing calls for leadership change at the Aspen School District. And your blue books are here. What are voters weighing as they mark their ballots this fall? Those stories and more coming up on Aspen Public Radio. I want to start with a tribute to David Whelan Eckert, who a Valley local who was biking in snowmass over the weekend. He's a co-author of Colorado Rivers and Creeks. We know that he saw a neighbor in the morning and is at the Woody Creek Trailer Park and was excited to go out and hit the trails and then was found by another rider, was able to speak at that point, but was not able to be revived when medical care came.
It's just another tragedy, and these are the things that we just hate to report.
And his adventurous life was so emblematic of what we think as a Valley local, with all his kayaking adventures, being a backcountry skier, and then, of course, hitting the mountain bike slopes when he could this summer. Did any of you know him?
I did not know him.
I did not. Knew the name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Madeline, I want to talk about how this relates to the death that we had last year. Another gentleman, David Duff, died on the same trail. Has Ski Coast said anything? I mean, they just created these trails.
Yes.
So it's not like they've been open for years and then we had this incident as if it was Capitol Peak or something like that. You know,
right.
they built these and it's
for
a route that has now claimed the 2 years it's been open, claimed two lives. Are they looking at the structure?
I think they're being very careful in what they're saying, because obviously it could be some lawsuit or I don't know if probably the same. It's probably like the Colorado Skier Safety Act, that once you're on those trails, it good luck and everything. I would hope that there'd be a little bit of examination, because I think if we had two people die, like hitting a tree on the Ridge Bell in that same 14-month period, that there would be some examination. And certainly those are Double Diamond expert trails. And that it's interesting, too, that both of the men who passed away on those trails had local connections. It's not like they were coming from Chicago, Indiana, where they didn't know what was to be expected. So
I would imagine he'd done it before, and these things just happen, unfortunately, and it's just terrible. I don't know what Ski Co can do. It probably would be prudent of them to examine it, but these trails are marked, and these people are familiar with them. And
that's certainly above
I have no desire to go down that trail.
Yeah,
like.
No. Yeah. And as you said, Double Black Diamond, I mean, it's marked similarly to ski runs, but like any grade, anything that, you know, is human-built, there is some sort of math involved, some sort of physics involved. Okay, if you're coming around this turn and then go down at this angle, you know, there's. I think people think really hard about how they are constructing trails. And it would be great to see something from Ski Co that they're at least looking sure and assuring safety. And then you take a Double Black Diamond and you know what you're getting into.
That's right.
Let's move on to the Aspen School District. Rick and Madeline, both a lot of coverage on this issue, and then Paul, I know you have some thoughts as well. 300 people have signed a petition asking for our superintendent to leave. It's worth reporting on, right? Some of the things we're hearing, Rick, is that this parent group, though, is being overly divisive, kind of being showy about it, and maybe not using the best tactics to have a conversation.
Well, I think That's one argument, but those tactics have resulted in what we're seeing now. And so I think, Paul, you noted in your column the other day, it's been simmering for a while, and now it's boiling over, and this sentiment has been there for a while. And sometimes, I'm not advocating for either side here, I want to be clear, but you have to make a stink to get people's attention, because killing them with kindness doesn't always work. And I think that this, what they're doing now, has been in a more effective route.
The meeting that Rick and I covered the other day, one of the moms, I believe it was Patsy, and the way she described it, and it's true because I felt this too, you have this child and you're a normal person, and then you become this this mama bear, this or this lioness who wants to protect and everything. And I think that some of these, and some of the people who started this uprising are rather new to the community. So maybe they were able, not Patsy, but to Bettina, and then there's another woman too who haven't been here that long. Maybe it needed an outside voice to strike this chord.
Yep. My concern is that, you know, any bureaucracy, and government bureaucracies in particular, can become kind of insular, self-reinforcing systems. And having, and to Rick's point, I think having people who are willing to take the risk to shake it up and say, hey, you know, there's more going on here than we know about. And you work for us. You know, if you're on the board, you work for us. You don't work for the superintendent. And let's, you know, so let's talk about these things. And sometimes you do have to shake it up a little bit.
I want to bring in some of that context of this has been simmering for a while. I actually went to the change.org website to see what the current petition is that's asking for John Malloy to be removed. I typed in Malloy to look for that. And the first thing that popped up was a 2014 change.org petition asking for Superintendent John Malloy to be removed from the school district. Mm-hmm. So you can't say this started this year. You can't say this started with newcomers. Mm-hmm. That had a similar amount, 200, 300 signatures. People were asking for this. And I think that boiling also has to do with feeling ignored. I mean, there's been votes of no confidence. There's been a district accountability committee who said, mm-hmm. we don't like what we're seeing. Are there things that we can do to change it? And clearly, it's steady as she goes. So I think there's also just a little bit of that pent-upness, and there's just you can document that this has been boiling for a while. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that board, because Dwayne Romero takes over as the chair of the school board. Do you guys have thoughts on how that might change some of the culture or leadership at Aspen School District?
I don't know if I'm in a position to say or predict what is going to change, but I think that Dwayne clearly comes from a different place than Sheila Wills on some of these things. And I think that there's a distinguishable difference between how they feel about things.
I would say he ran on, he was just elected last election, mm-hmm. last fall, to reserve on the school board. And he ran on, let's listen to teachers, let's make sure some of these cultural issues are being listened to. And I think that's been his response during these meetings, where he's heard people come up and speak against some of the cultural stuff right now.
Well, and Dwayne's wife also, Margaret, who's wonderful, she taught at the elementary school, and now she's at community school. So clearly Dwayne has some insight into, and I'm sure he will keep that in, you know, as a professional and be, but he has some insight.
And there's also, you know, the board and the administration, one could argue that they're kind of in this rarefied air, and they're not, they don't see things that people are seeing on the ground there, but... I'd almost think more so with the administration than the board.
Okay. There's a lot of self-referential, we're doing fine, steady mm-hmm. as she goes kind of discussion, even when we hear the feedback mm-hmm. that there's been some complaints. But they are moving forward under Sheila Wills. They've decided to find some sort of new review or mediation. Do they know, have they said exactly what they're going to do to kind of change the system or get a new eye on this?
Well, they are going to do a study
But the thing is that they vote on, or they don't vote because if it was a vote, it would need to be done in public. But they will be discussing. They actually went to an executive session yesterday and the day before to evaluate his contract. And then they will decide on it on October 15th, is my understanding. Yeah.
And this might all, so that you're saying the contract might get re-upped before we have the opportunity for some of this cultural inspection.
Yeah, I almost think the mediator is being done to placate people, but it's almost like, you know, the bull has gone through the china shop and the mediator third party will come in there and try to clean it up.
Well, one quote I thought was interesting in one of your stories was that someone on the school board said, well, we can't have someone come and consult with us as to what the culture should be until we know what we want the culture to be. Why don't they know that? Why don't they know that they want it to be a good, open, lovely workplace environment?
That's part of the problem, yeah. I think. I think that's one of the reasons why you have so many parents that are concerned in a general sense.
And there's also, I mean, And I brought this to John Malloy's attention because there have been some rumblings. Well, why aren't the reporters sticking through the whole meetings? Well, fine. But, you know, we from the hospital, the town of Basalt, town of Snowmass Village, city of Aspen, Pitkin County, all of their meetings, other than like work sessions or P&Z, are videoed.
Absolutely.
And the hospital doesn't even have grassroots come in there, but they do it themselves, and they will stream it the next day. The board meeting, nothing, you know, and at this meeting on Monday, you have 80 people shoehorned into a room maybe twice as big. The democracy is not people hanging out in the hallways.
Right.
That's right.
You know, trying to hear what's being said. And that's a problem.
Madeline, did you speak directly to John Malloy?
I have on 3 or 4 occasions in the last week. Yes.
So he hasn't responded to my request for an interview. And it's not that he's denied them. He has not responded to them. Rick, I don't know if you've had a chance to talk directly with him.
Talked to him and emailed him.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, too, like shows, wouldn't you want to talk? Can you tell me a little bit about those interviews, those one-on-ones? How is he feeling?
You know, how is he feeling? I felt like he was really upfront. He was trying to make his case. Last week, I tried to reach him twice in advance of the first story I did. So I don't feel he's hiding anything. I feel maybe he thinks what he is doing is correct. They feel like it's a siege. And his daughter also. And it was interesting, you know, all this unfolded on the same day last week as the Kavanaugh hearings.
Wow.
Well, and it's interesting to me also because Megan Malloy, when she spoke, she was very defensive and she almost came across as Judge Kavanaugh, just in her persona, like, I did nothing wrong and blah, blah, blah. And I respect her for standing up and saying that, but the irony to me wasn't lost.
That's not to say that she's not qualified,
absolutely.
But it's just that access that she has to the superintendent.
Although there was a letter in the Thursday Aspen Times questioning that from Lauren Cassette, who was a longtime district employee and former Aspen Times employee.
Right.
Well, questioning what?
Questioning
her qualifications?
Yes.
Well, I mean, qualifications are irrelevant in cases of nepotism. If you have a nepotism policy, your qualifications are not a part of that. So it is an awkward look. I mean, I don't really understand it because neither of my daughters would ever want to work for me. So I don't get that at all. But that's another issue.
Well, and there is a quote that John Malloy did not know that his daughter had applied for the job until she came up as one of the final candidates. And that also just didn't seem right to me. You're applying, like, from out of state, you're applying at the very school where your father runs the place, and you didn't tell him?
Strains the bounds of believability.
You are listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. You're hearing from Paul Mentor, who is a columnist with the Aspen Daily News, Madeline Osberger, contributing editor with the Aspen Daily News, and Rick Carroll, who's the managing editor with the Aspen Times. Stay with us. All right, Paul, with your city insight, I'm very excited to talk to you about some of the election measures that Aspenites will be voting on. And then, of course, there's impact on the rest of the valley as well. Let's talk about two really obscure ones, there's two things that are just kind of charter-based.
Right.
One of them has to do with franchise agreements, and one of them has to do with allowing the city to take out bonds before, without turning to the voters first. Let's start on that one, because that is a financial thing.
Sure, that the First Amendment has to do with enterprise fund debt.
Okay.
And the city is asking the voters to change the charter so that voters don't get to vote on what are called limited obligation or special obligation bonds. So these are not full faith and credit obligation, general obligation bonds of the city. These would be bonds that the city's electric utility or water utility or stormwater utility would issue for construction projects and
okay.
the like. And they so they're not full faith and credit, and that is consistent with Tabor. Tabor does not require a vote on those kinds of bonds. The charter, which was adopted by the city in 1972, always has. So now 25, 26 years after Tabor was adopted, the city has decided they want to align with Tabor. And, you know, my perspective on it is that two things. Number one, if it isn't broke, don't fix it. It's been working fine. The voters approve these issues. It keeps the voters in touch. And the second issue is at a time when voters seem to be wanting more, not less involvement, why is the city asking the voters to eliminate some of their say in the city's business? By not allowing them to vote on these issues, then voters are less aware and less informed of what's going on. You know, 2014 was referendum 1A on the development in downtown. And, they've continued to have issues with voters wanting to have a say with the lawsuit on the Galena Plaza office option, which has been a problem for them. And rather than embrace that and deal with that constructively with the voting base that clearly wants to be involved, their approach seems to be to try and give the voters less say. And I don't understand that.
Well, so if you're going in as a voter, what is a yes vote? You know, like how would the yes vote benefit, especially the city, I think is what I'm curious about when I'm trying to make my decision.
What it does is it puts the hands of approving utility bonds, enterprise fund bonds, in the hands of the council exclusively. And now the voters, I believe, would still have the power of referral. They could refer those. If the council approved a bond issue that the voters didn't like, they could do a petition and they could send it to the voters that way. But the voters are not proactively involved, so it's less costly.
Okay.
It's more certain in some sense, and it focuses that responsibility to the council rather than the voters.
Let me pick perhaps all of your brains about the city hall question.
Mm-hmm.
That's a scrape and replace project if we go to Hopkins, right? So are people voting on a building that they don't know what it's going to look like? The city could give itself variances on height and mass and things like that. Whereas the Galena Plaza, if we say yes to that one, we know what it'll look like. They'll use the plans we've already seen.
I think the short answer on that is yes, and it's not so much that you don't know what the building's going to be. It's just the Galena Plaza option's been vetted for 3 years. And now at the very last minute, you're looking at this option for Hopkins. And there are conceptual plans that I've seen. And so, and Rick and Madeline probably have more insight on this than I do because they do this every day. But there are conceptual plans, but it's all very conceptual. And you know, is this building really going to meet the functional needs of the city? I mean, you got something that, you know, you got a developer coming at the last minute who gives you an option versus something that you studied for 3 years. I mean, which option do you think has the higher likelihood of meeting your needs?
And that price agreements with Mark Hunt with the city of Aspen, that the thing that voters are being asked to decide in the fall has already been negotiated. That purchase has already
right.
been negotiated.
Contract signed.
That's been negotiated at a higher rate than the valuation of the building came in at.
My understanding of some more excellent reporting from the Aspen Times with Karen Zachariasen was the issue of the Randy Gold appraisal on the 517 mm-hmm. Hopkins piece, I think. And then they're still waiting. I think Dave Ritter is doing the appraisal. They have yet to see that on the Aspen kitchen space. And so, yes, it was the verbal appraisal. Why would you you ask for a verbal appraisal unless you didn't want anybody to know that you were getting an appraisal, right? And in fairness to the city, in a case where you're negotiating for the purchase, it's absolutely legitimate for the city to try and keep that kind of information confidential. That's not what this case is. This is a case where they've got a contract. And then after the fact, they go back and they ask for an appraisal. It's backwards. So,
BMC West.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That didn't go to voters, but yeah.
No, same exact issue. Mm-hmm. 10 years later.
City overpaid for that lot that's near Mountain Rescue.
Well, they never got an appraisal on it, actually, did they?
They did an appraisal after they bought it.
After they bought it.
Yeah. And right. they went back and forth and back and forth. That was after I left. That was
kind of like doing a background check on somebody after you hire them.
Oh, right. Wow.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I was the city's finance director when that issue was negotiated.
They didn't ask your opinion?
They did not ask my opinion. I was asked to find out a way to finance it. It became a political issue in 2009. A couple of the candidates for office actually blamed me for recommending it to the city council.
That's so exciting that you've been involved
yeah.
in the
and
the
I did not recommend it to them. It was one of the issues that solidified my decision to move on, actually.
Yeah, but I would be interested to see what that's worth today. And having sat on it for 10 years, I mean, they aren't making land anymore. You know, the property is still there. Maybe they'll finally do something with it or sell
right.
it.
Right.
And they are generating revenue there, too. From the
sure,
tenant,
yes.
I don't know what they're making, but
there's a lease. The lumberyard pays them a lease for mm-hmm. it, so they're property managers now on what was supposed to be affordable housing, but clearly can't work as affordable housing, or they would have developed it by now.
Why do you say that? Why they kept saying, well, maybe we're going to sit on it as we redevelop the airport, that would be a good for housing there. Why don't you think it can be housing?
I think there are too many restrictions. I think it's too close to the airport. I think the access to the highway is a challenge. I think there are lots of reasons why they haven't moved forward on that parcel and have just sat on it.
It is near Annie Mitchell, which is affordable mm-hmm. housing. So it seems like maybe they could complement each other if that were ever worked out.
I think that was one of the reasons why the city purchased. Clearly, it's one of the reasons why the city purchased it. And I think it conceptually, I think that's correct. I think it's more a matter of volume than it is purpose. Clearly is intended to be a high density affordable housing project. So a lot more people, a lot more vehicles, a lot more transportation requirements. It's closer to the freeway. There are setback issues with the parcel, I understand. And I don't remember all the details at this point. And it was never really clear to me. I wasn't involved in the due diligence on that. I just think that 10 years later, if you have a valuable piece of property and you've been sitting on it, there's got to be a reason why you're not developing it.
Let's talk about someone else who cannot get a loan, even though they've been promised month after month after month that they're almost there. Rick, how's the Aspen Club doing? And I want to say last time I think I had the two of you, Madeline and Rick, on mm-hmm. together at the same time was our April 20th show. And we talked about the Aspen Club and that maybe they were about to get a loan then.
Rick, you did the most recent reporting, so I'll defer to you on this.
Well, I sat in on the teleconference call on with this really complicated lawsuit brought on by the general contractor, PCL. But listen, we keep hearing it's going to be next month. Now we're hearing October. There comes a point where you can't hear that anymore.
Right.
And I think that it goes, they have a deadline with the foreclosure office until next March, I believe, because this foreclosure auction or process was launched this past year. And so it will have been a year if we get to March. And then are they going to get the refi? I don't know if they're going to go into receivership or bankruptcy or if this magical group of investors back east has that money, but it's just right now it's just talk.
It is,
and it's just lip service almost. We're just repeating ourselves.
And it's a little boy who cries wolf, right? Like at some point you're not going to believe that.
Yeah, and I think that Michael Fox is probably obviously buying a little time, and I think that he's well intended in all this, but it's a mess.
Yeah,
I don't think it's just.
And it is telling that it's been over a year now since anything stopped, since the on the site. So,
and there's something like $30 million in debt, right? So, like, first things first, pay everyone back and then start construction again. Or is best case scenario they sell the land? It's someone else's project. It's someone else's to do whatever they want with it.
In this particular lawsuit, everyone who's owed money is supposed to come up with an affidavit saying how much they are owed, so that the potential lender can have all of this in writing to see what is owed here. And I think that's the next step. But there's also and that's the foreclosure process being brought by the general contractor through the judicial means.
Okay.
But there's the other one that's being brought through by the lender through the treasurer's office. There are different ways to foreclose on properties. And so you have two different foreclosures underway.
And Michael Fox isn't talking.
No, he's accessible, but okay. he travels a lot. I think Michael has been very good about getting back to me. I don't think he's crazy about it, but he's like, they're calling me again this week. But he realizes he's accountable to the community, but he doesn't have much to report at this time, publicly.
Lots of complicated, heavy stuff this week. So, Madeline, I would love to end on an article about the Aspen Animal Shelter. So this week, people were evacuated from the Roaring Fork apartments in Basalt. There's a water main break, and they'll have to stay out of their homes for weeks until that's all back up and running. And Seth at the animal shelter stepped right up and said, I'll help you with pets.
I'll help you. Clearing space, bringing in. I was really touched by that. And you're right. It was a week of very heavy news. And then to have, you know, this is where we come together as a community, our love of animals. And for them just to open it up. And Seth and Chad stayed late that night too. And then nobody brought their pets, which is great because that means people found other avenues. They're still keeping that option open. And also, if they can't afford it, that they will waive those fees.
And it just mirrors the Lake Christine fire, another time when people had to evacuate a couple months ago, and that's who took in the pets.
I mean, you have to realize, and we were talking about this in the office this week, just because I've been evacuated. We had a fire in our apartment building 15 years ago, 13 years ago, and it was horrifying. And we weren't able to grab anything, and we ran out. And I think that the effects of that, and we had to go back and get our cat also. And I would have really appreciated that support at the time. We were able to move in somewhere that allowed pets, but I think it's just one of the things that makes Aspen great.
Mm-hmm. Madeline Osberger is a contributing editor with the Aspen Daily News. She's joined by Rick Carroll, managing editor with the Aspen Times, and Paul Mentor, columnist with the Aspen Daily News here on Valley Roundup today. Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Allison Bektesh. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.